There's also a story about climate change and the extent that powerful interests are willing to go to help their bottom line, which includes manipulating the media. So I'm going to start with our first piece. Terry Dunn knew all too well this reality. He was an Alabama resident who wanted to do right by his neighbors and figure out why power bills were so high. And I'm talking really high here. Alabama residents have the highest power bills of any state in the country, despite being one of the poorest. So in 2010, Dunn ran for a seat on the State Energy Commission. He wanted to hold a formal rate hearing at which Alabama power executives would have to open their financial books and answer questions. That hadn't happened for nearly three decades. But soon, Dunn found himself the target of political smears online, and he lost his reelection campaign. But what Dunn hadn't known at the time is that the news sites that attacked him were taking money from Matrix. Our reporting revealed it was an orchestrated attack, and Dunn was not the only target of this consulting firm. By verifying a trove of documents we had received and following the money, we traced a web of six news outlets across Alabama and Florida with financial connections to Matrix. We found that between 2013 and 2020, Matrix paid the six news outlets just under $1 million. Through the sites, Matrix shrewdly took advantage of the near collapse of the local news industry and found a way to push its own messaging. Those articles were influential in shaping state policy, including around solar in the Sunshine State. This story ended up having so many details we had to split it into two, and they both had real impact. A month before this story was published, Alabama Power's CEO Mark Crosswhite announced his retirement well after our reporting had been underway. And a month after our story came out, Florida Power & Light's Eric Szilagyi announced his early retirement. But this series was just the tip of the iceberg. We realized that that there are several other instances where the oil and gas industry and utilities are taking advantage of the collapsing news industry. I reported one story earlier this year that found a utility financially backed two news sites in Alabama, including a historic black newspaper. Another piece that was actually published last week documented how Chevron had grown a network of news-seeming sites from Ecuador to Richmond, California, to the Permian Basin, which oversees West Texas and New Mexico. I found that reporting out these kind of investigations takes persistence, extreme document diving, and if you're lucky, some good old-fashioned feuding. Thank you.
Thank you, Miranda. Next up, we have a story that's a little more human-focused and like a little more less on the climate change side and more on like telling the story and saga of environmental pollution and efforts to cover it up. We have Sharon Lerner, reporter from ProPublica. Okay,
great. Hi, I'm so excited to be here and talk about this. And I would like to say, yes, this is a story about people, and it's a story about chemicals, but it's also a climate story, I think. And that's because the chemical that I'm talking about here is ethylene oxide, which is made from methane and from petroleum. And when it is made, it emits greenhouse gases. And I should say also this reporting I did when I was at The Intercept, a reporter at The Intercept. I'm now at ProPublica. So I did a series of stories about ethylene oxide, excuse me, and one of them enabled me, basically using EPA data, to look at the spots in the United States, the census tracts, where they had the highest cancer risk. I wasn't able to include every part of this table, but when you can see it all, the yellow part is ethylene oxide. And according to law, the EPA is supposed to protect us from exposure to any chemical that causes one, more than one in a million cancers over a lifetime, right? And these are the 109 census tracts that had way more than, well, they all had over 100, some of them way more, over one in a million and some way more. And we'll get to the misinformation part soon, but what kind of spurred these stories was that the EPA had reassessed ethylene oxide and were taking another look at its cancer-causing potential. And when they did, and this was a few years ago, they ended up finding that it was much more carcinogenic than they previously thought. And so in doing this, what happened was you could suddenly see that there are areas around the country where they had a really elevated cancer risk. One of the places where that happened was Willowbrook, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. And when they did that, right before they released the numbers, the EPA sent folks to Willowbrook, which is, Willowbrook, I should say, is a wealthy suburb of Chicago. It's mostly white. And the folks there got really upset, understandably. They ended up raising a ruckus. They had a lot of lawyers and scientists and journalists in their neighborhoods. And they ended up shutting down the plant that emitted the chemical. Another of these towns, but let me see. We can't see from here, but Willowbrook isn't even on. These are the top, you know, the biggest cancer risk. So Willowbrook is much further down. And what I found with one of my first stories was that the places that had far bigger cancer risks, St. John the Baptist among them, you can see it's the top one, they didn't get the same treatment. They weren't told about what was found, and they didn't get their plant shut down. Let me go back for a sec. when I took another look at ethylene oxide after this, I was talking to the people in the various communities that were highly affected. And after lots and lots of conversations, one person mentioned to me, and this is actually in another Illinois town that was not Willowbrook, far less wealthy, and was an advocate who was telling me that she had been looking at the data that is available on the EPA through this database, the Toxic Release Inventory, and she had noticed that the amount of ethylene oxide that her local polluter had admitted to releasing had changed. So she said, suddenly, the 8,422 pounds the Lake County plant had said they had admitted in 2013 appeared as 2,831. And then she noticed other numbers had gotten smaller, too. And so when I ended up speaking to other folks in other communities, I actually heard a couple of people say the same thing. Wow, our local polluter, suddenly the numbers seem to have changed. And so this ends up being a story about a different kind of misinformation, not coming from the kind of source you usually expect, which is to say, it was from an EPA database. So what had happened, I put together after bunch of reporting, is that when the companies saw this change coming, right, they knew from the EPA that they were going to change the official standard for the official recognition for how much of this chemical was dangerous. What happened was they ended up changing their reports to the EPA about how much they admitted. So suddenly it was, in the end, seven companies that changed their reports. And in the end, it was 270,000 pounds difference between what they originally said and what they changed to after they hurt they heard basically that basically they saw that they were going to get in trouble if they left their emissions the way they were, and without actually reducing their emissions, they changed their reports. So it was a lesson to me, and I think maybe a lesson to other journalists too. Like this thing, you know, you wouldn't expect misinformation from, you know, an EPA database, the TRI, but the TRI, it turns out, was full of misinformation because it was coming from the companies. So in terms of impact from this story or these series of stories, the differential, the sort of looking at the disparities in the responses in the various towns sparked an EPA IG report, and I have 30 seconds left, and in the past couple weeks, EPA announced that they are changing their and tightening their standards on ethylene oxide, which, you know, I hope had to do with this a little bit. So, yeah, so misinformation from a funny source, the EPA. There you go.
Thank you, Sharon. There's a reporting piece of advice that someone gave me many years ago when trying to decide on what kind of story to do that I always think about now. It's either you can try to make something, take something small and make it really big, or you can take something big and try to make it small enough so that it's consumable and understandable for people. This next story is a really important example of something taking something really big, the build out of liquefied natural gas infrastructure and making it small and digestible and easy to understand. This is Holly Parker. This is Holly Parker with WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio.
Hi, everybody. Wow, okay. All right, so my tone of my presentation is going to be a little bit different because audio is such a different medium from print. You can only include so much. So this series is called All Gassed Up. For now, I'm going to just, I really liked how we introduced the story in our podcast, so I'm going to play that. But just to explain this photo here, you're looking at a liquefied natural gas export plant in southwest Louisiana, right along the border of Louisiana, Texas. And if you don't know what liquefied natural gas is, you probably do, but it is super cool natural gas that is then able to be shipped from the U.S. overseas. So I'm going to pull this up.
Lyle and I live in New Orleans. We've been reporting until they figure out the answer to why stakes are way bigger. Lyle and I live in New Orleans. Gas execs came to New Orleans, or supported by the Pulitzer Center. Right now in the U.S., there is a gas boom, a liquefied natural gas boom, or LNG. The U.S. now produces more LNG than any other country in the world. In the epicenter of this booming new business, the reason all those fancy gas execs came to New Orleans, it's here on the Gulf Coast.
If you've been listening to Sea Change for a while, you know Carlisle and I live in New Orleans. We've been reporting on major industries all along the coast for years, but recently we started to hear more and more about the next big industry. It was LNG. For the last year, we've been crisscrossing the state trying to uncover what this growing LNG industry means for Louisiana.
But after talking with everyone, from shrimpers to energy insiders, we realized that the stakes are way bigger. If we really wanted to tell the whole story, we had to travel even farther. In this three-part series, we follow the journey of American gas around the world to find out if LNG is the miracle fuel it's claimed to be. If it really can prevent a climate apocalypse.
Or is it a carbon bomb waiting to go off?
Today, we start at home, in Louisiana, with a guy in a trailer who's pissed.
I wish you had enough time to listen to the guy in the trailer who's pissed off. but we do not. But you start to hear from that, right, that we were really looking at this driving question of, we're going back to, again, to the gas industry here, which has long had this argument that gas is clean, as we've heard from other folks, and also that it can be this transitional or bridge fuel to get from dirtier fossil fuels like coal all the way to renewable energy. And so we were really trying to examine that branding of that branding and how it has extended to LNG as well, and questioning this marketing of this LNG gas expansion that's happening on the Gulf Coast. So initially, this all started from a NPR feature piece that I did in 2022 after the Ukraine war kicked off, happened, terrible things happened. And when that happened, there was really this big campaign. You know, Biden said we needed to start exporting more LNG. The gas industry also started using that as a reason to build more giant LNG export plants on the Gulf Coast. And there was really this question of just, do we actually need to do this? How much LNG does Europe actually need? How many export plants do we need to build in order to meet that need? And also, is this even actually for Europe? Where is this gas actually going? Because as we started to figure out, it wasn't really for Europe. The final destination for this is really Asia. You know, there is this recycled promotion of natural gas as a clean fuel and that it has a place in fixing climate change. And, you know, it became clear that this was something that was not just central to the Gulf Coast, but this was a global story. And so from this feature piece, I was like, I started dreaming up this idea for actually getting to travel, go and follow the gas and take people on this journey with the gas. So we wanted to go from the Gulf Coast to Germany and then to Japan or Asia. And it took a while to get there because WWNO is a small newsroom. And our podcast, Sea Change, is also a small team. It actually didn't exist when I first started to think about this idea. But eventually that happened. It took like several months for this to get in place and to also get the buy-in from my editors. And we also were able to get a grant from the Pulitzer Center to actually fund this travel. So that was super exciting. And it was really cool to know, like, as a local reporter, that there are resources to be able to do one of these gigantic projects, you know. So once we were able to get that grant going, then there was the challenge of like actually trying to, there's the challenge of actually trying to plan this trip among trying to do all of your daily reporting. But luckily we did have that editor and like management buy-in in order to be able to get this done. And that's very critical. So editors out there, please try to support your reporters when they're trying to do these big ambitious projects. Thank you, Lee. You know, even though it was really challenging to plan this trip, it was also super rewarding. And we ended up doing a ton of background interviews to try to figure out, you know, what the actual issues are. This guy was not a challenge. He was very nice. I just really liked that photo. And we also had to try to figure out how to make something as wonky as liquefied natural gas actually palatable for audio, because that is very challenging, especially for me, because I come from a print background, so it would have been much easier to just take all this information, put it in a story, let people see the facts and figures. But unfortunately, for audio, you can't really have that many numbers in there. You really want to, so we were trying to figure out a way to find some really strong characters, which includes that guy in a trailer, John Allaire, who like lives next to a LNG plant on the Gulf Coast. We found a shrimper, Travis Dardar, who was able to talk about how he was displaced from his home, had a buyout, and now has to travel a really long way to go shrimping, to try to make this impact actually real for people. And then when it came to the subsequent episodes, going to Germany to talk about how actually this gas isn't going to be needed in Germany for as long as at least they're signing contracts for. They're signing long-term contracts for 15 to 20 years, and they have climate goals that will have them off of gas much before that. So then it raises that question of then, oh, if you're locked into this gas, like, where is that going to go next? And they're just like, we're going to sell it to someone else. And who is that someone else? That's Asian countries. And we looked at who was the enabler over in Asia. And it turned out that it was Japan. And, you know, you start to see how this is super complicated. And so we started to try to just make the writing just really kind of fun. Like in our third episode, we call Japan the sugar daddy of LNG. And we also just to make this vital point, we also had to be super flexible with talking about this journey, making sure that for me personally, we have a digital that's going to be coming out. So I was able to decide to put all of those kind of facts and figures in there and trying to make sure that all the interesting fun bits kind of stay in the audio version so that we can kind of reach different audiences. And this is rolling out right now, so I don't have a ton of impact for you, but I hope that you check it out.
Thank you. All right, there's a wealth of stories, obviously, in the industries that are polluting the environment and the climate, but there's also a wealth of stories in some of the proposed solutions to our environmental problems. Pam Radke, the Gulf Coast Managing Editor of Floodlight, is going to talk about one of them, carbon capture.
Okay, not a solution. Let's just start there. I've been writing about carbon capture and sequestration since the early 2000s when the Department of Energy awarded $1.1 billion for 11 carbon capture projects. And if you know anything about carbon capture, you know those projects were largely a failure. A project to capture greenhouse gas emissions from the Kemper coal plant in Mississippi was demolished because it didn't work as intended, and Petranova closed down because it was uneconomic. So I thought when I started looking about and hearing about the blue hydrogen in Louisiana, the blue ammonia plants, and these big industrial projects that started rolling out, I'm going to say 2017, 28, 2019, Hallie's written about them quite a bit, I just rolled my eyes and thought, this isn't a story, this isn't going to happen. But guess what happened? two things happened. Under the IRA, boosted tax credits for capturing and permanently storing carbon. Before, one of the arguments against carbon capture was there was no market for it. So they would capture the carbon, and there was nowhere to put it. So that's why a lot of the plants closed down. So the IRA increased tax credits for capturing and permanently storing carbon from $50 per metric ton to $85. And suddenly, voila, there was a market. The second thing that happened was the oil and gas industry saw an opportunity to allow their oil and gas to continue and say it was clean. And you may have heard this quote that the CEO of Occidental Petroleum said, "We believe that our direct capture technology is going to be the technology to preserve our industry over time. This gives our industry a license to continue to operate for 60, 70, 80 years that I think is going to be very needed." So you've got these carbon credits, you've got the oil and gas industry taking advantage of these carbon credits, and then all of a sudden you have 200 carbon capture and sequestration projects all over the United States, half of which have been announced since those credits passed and became law, the IRA credits. And in all these announcements, they say clean energy. So blue, I don't know if you guys know, you probably do know that blue hydrogen and blue ammonia are ammonia and hydrogen produced with natural gas, and they say blue. And in Louisiana, where I live, all these blue projects are also being called clean. So there's a lot of reasons. I mean, we already know that the natural gas industry wants to label its product as clean, but that, you know, they're not doing anything but capturing the carbon. So then the question becomes, does carbon capture work? You know, announcement after announcement, developers of these carbon capture and sequestration projects said they're going to be able to capture, you know, 99% of this carbon. Well, that, you know, I knew from previous, you know, the previous round, you don't capture 99% of the carbon capture. So I just started looking at it. I had this question, which was, how does building brand new industries help meet the nation or Louisiana's goals to hit net zero by 2050? New industries in the state, including LNG, mean that Louisiana's carbon footprint is supposed to increase by 100 metric tons a year over the next decade to 243 metric tons a year. Louisiana is one of the top emitters of carbon dioxide in the nation because of our industry. We have 1% of the population, but we emit 4% of the carbon dioxide. So the Louisiana is targeted because we have plenty of carbon to capture because of this industry, and we also have plenty of underground, according to the geologists, plenty of underground deep pore space. So I started looking at this and trying to figure out, like, you know, knowing from historically that this doesn't work, and I thought this should be an easy story, and it wasn't, because there's an organization, just like all the other previous incidents or, you know, stories that have been explained here, there's a group called the Carbon Capture Coalition, which has industry partners, and it also has some nonprofits that are supporting carbon capture. This organization used to be called the National Enhanced Oil Recovery Initiative. So this was all backing enhanced oil recovery, which uses captured carbon and sequester captured carbon to bring up more oil out of the aging oil and gas fields. So I kept just asking around and trying to figure out how well these carbon capture and sequestration projects were supposed to perform. And even though there's like the Carbon Capture Coalition says 99%, the Institute of Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says that the average carbon capture rate is 75%. And then so some of these organizations are saying, some of these companies are saying, we're going to use renewable energy. We're not going to use natural gas. Well, I have to tell them all something, that we only have 4% renewable energy in Louisiana, so I'm not sure how that's going to work. And that renewable energy is also suggested to be used for a direct air capture project in southwest Louisiana. We're obviously not going to have enough renewable energy to power both of these projects. And then greenhouse gas emissions aside, many of the people who live around these projects, these proposed plants, are going to be exposed to increased emissions of particulate matter and nitrogen oxides. And so let's say best case scenario, 99% of the facility's greenhouse gas emissions are captured. But then you have to ask the question, is it going to stay put? And then you have to also ask, are they going to use these captured emissions for an enhanced oil recovery? And they still get a credit from the IRA. So oil and gas companies and utilities are already declaring carbon capture a winner. And it is for those companies want to keep producing oil and gas, they're going to use carbon capture. But there are so many caveats to this technology. It's way too soon for anyone to decide. And so my whole point is to encourage everybody here. It took me a long time to get to this one story, and I've written stories since then, that it takes a lot to understand the technology. There are so many aspects to it. And just like most oil and gas, there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation and, you know, trying to get people to look the other way, say, this is all great, we're going to solve our climate problem by spending billions of dollars on a technology that may or may not work. So I encourage all of you, we have a carbon capture and sequestration dinner Friday night. If anybody has any questions or if anybody wants to join me in trying to track down what's going on with this carbon capture and sequestration, I welcome you. So thanks.
Thank you, Pam. Our final story is from Maria Paraso Rose. Diving into some of the real origins, violent origins of the climate crisis in the U.S. Maria Paraza Rose is a data reporter for GRISP, going to be talking about land grab universities.
Hey. Cool. Happy Wednesday. My name is Maria Peraza Rose, and I'm a spatial data analyst at GRIST on the Indigenous Affairs Desk. and I was the lead data reporter on our recently published project, Misplaced Trust, which is what I'm here to talk about today. Our 18-month investigation is a story about the connections between higher education and Indigenous land dispossession. And ultimately, the project reveals how land ownership policies in the 1800s, specifically through things called state trust lands, helped create the climate crisis that's happening right now. For this session, I'm going to focus on how our piece sheds light on the ongoing Indigenous land dispossession and wealth transfer. And this dispossession isn't always easy to see, in large part because it's hidden in plain sight thanks to time and misleading stereotypes. In the context of this talk, history and American mythology are the disinformation that we're battling against. So, to start, what are state trust lands? When territories were brought into the Union and granted statehood, the federal government gifted them large swaths of land. This was mostly in states west of the Mississippi. So when you fly over the Midwest and see these grid-like lines on the ground, those patterns reflect the parceling out of these lands. States were given sections of these lands to build up their public institutions, like hospitals, asylums, state departments, but the main recipients of these lands were K-12 schools and universities. States would sell or lease out those parcels and then send the revenue to beneficiaries. And to be clear, when I say beneficiaries from here on out, I'm talking about the entities receiving the revenue from these trust lands. In short, states are kind of like the original Nepo babies of the federal government. In our investigation, we narrowed our analysis to look just at state trust lands benefiting land-grant universities. This was our way of building on High Country News' work with the project Land Grab Universities and bringing that methodology from the past into the present. We found 14 universities profiting from 8.36 million surface and subsurface acres taken from 123 tribes. And between 2018 and 2022, those lands produced $6.7 billion in revenue for their associated institutions. Here's a static view of the map that we made on the website, which you can interact with and explore online. We also figured out how these parcels were being used by doing this very cool and very aggravating spatial join with dozens of land activity data sets we collected from different state agencies. And we found that many of these universities benefit from extractive industries that contribute to climate change. For example, nearly 25% of the land-grant university trust lands are designated for either fossil fuel production or the mining of minerals like coal and iron-rich taconite. In comparison, land set aside for renewable resources were just 0.25 of all the acreage. Now, the story that land-grant universities have usually told about these grants is that they were a way for the federal government to provide free land for universities to sell in order to support education for the masses and fuel economic growth. But as we know now, that land wasn't free. For all these state trust lands and the resources and revenue that they've generated since, Indigenous nations were paid about $4.7 million when adjusted for inflation. And in many cases, Indigenous nations were never compensated for the theft of their land. An example of this disparity can be seen in timber extraction in Washington. Timber harvesting has a small footprint in our data set, but we identified how, over time, it was a significant revenue source. From statehood in 1889 to 2022, timber sales on Washington trust land sent $1.1 billion to Washington State University when adjusted for inflation. For the acreage connected to the university, the associated tribal nations were paid $520,000, adjusted for inflation. So, real quick, what were some of the challenges? This was an intensive data journalism piece, and as anyone who has worked with data can commiserate, there were many, many, many challenges. And one element that I felt was unique to this project was how the scope of the data we were looking for spanned so widely across time. For example, when we reached out to states to clarify whether they still had trust lands benefiting these universities, some of them just didn't know the answer. And this isn't a reflection on them. Rather, it shows how old these land policies are and how embedded these structures are within state funding systems. These are some of the other challenges. Grumpy states, geometric matching. In this piece, we refer to this issue as one of the best-kept public secrets in America. To me, what we mean by that is the state trust land system is a policy that is so foundational that it's not easy to question or think to question how it shapes land. And so I wanted to bring up one other story that we used, the data that we collected for Misplaced Trust. This was the art for the story. I think it's cool. As we did our analysis for the first investigation, we saw a few instances of trust lands on reservation land, which was confusing to us. How did state-owned lands come to be on land legally reserved for tribal nations? This is an example of state trust lands on the Uinta and Ouray Reservation. These are state trust lands sending revenue to land-grant institutions, which in this case was Utah State University. We saw examples of this on several reservations and wanted to learn more. So I worked on a story with Anna Smith from High Country News in that corner, who's here today to explore this. And we expanded our scope to find any and all state trust lands that overlap with reservations. That means beneficiaries that included K-12 schools, hospitals, penitentiaries, and other state institutions, not just land-grant universities. Ultimately, in the states that we already had data for, we found 1.6 million surface and subsurface acres that overlap 83 tribal reservations. And we're in the process now of collecting the data for the other remaining states. Here is another map of the Uinta and Ouray Reservation showing trust lands for all beneficiaries. I bring this story up because I think it's a powerful visual that emphasizes the issue we're trying to highlight, which is that we may have been taught to see tribal nations on reservations as a resolution to the land dispossession that took place to create the U.S., but there's a continuing cost. And here we can see instances like this where states actively make money off of reserved indigenous land for state institutions and non-native citizens. Okay, how does this connect to disinformation? Indigenous nations are constantly fighting an onslaught of stereotypes and disinformation about how their citizens receive free college education or are leeching off the government. In reality, not only is that false, but the opposite of it is true. Our reporting shows that federal and state government continues to rely on indigenous lands to support settlers. And one last example I'd like to bring up is this report from 2018 called Reclaiming Native Truth. It names and explains the biases that keep Native Americans invisible, misrepresented, and restrained from achieving full political, economic, and social equality. These are things that Indigenous peoples have known, but this report conducted the research and collected the receipts to quantify it. And so this report lists out some of the most persistent and toxic negative narratives, like one myth that many Native Americans receive government benefits or handouts that other people don't while getting rich off casinos and not working. Another is the feeling of confusion about how tribes can be both sovereign nations and, quote, rely on the government. And in fact, the report shows that many people believe the atrocities done to Native Americans ended in the 19th century and that they underestimate the discrimination Native people face in comparison with other racial groups and queer communities. The lights are reacting to me, clearly. In truth, the United States has broken more than 500 legal treaties with tribes that were here long before the nation was established. Today, there are nearly 600 sovereign nations in the U.S., and their residents are citizens of both their own nations and the United States, and they pay federal taxes like all Americans. So the connection we're trying to show here is that governments continue to claim and take wealth from indigenous nations. Our investigation is an example of a story that highlights how the histories that disguise this dispossession are a manufactured form of disinformation. And these histories are continually weaponized. In this case, the weaponized discrimination offsets your tax dollars, and doubly so for those of you living in the West. And that is what I have. Thank you for your time.
Let's give a big round of applause to all the reporters who presented their stories. That is all of the lightning talks we have. If you have any questions for any of the reporters about any of their stories, now is certainly the time to ask them. I can have Lee give you the microphone, but yeah, floor is open if you want to ask anything about how to do this stuff.
And I know we're already a few minutes over, so we're probably going to keep this relatively brief, but if we have any questions for our Lightning Talk speakers.
Hi, thank you. This is a question for Maria. Thank you so much. But I did have a question. You know, data journalism is so intense, and you start with a bunch of information. How did you know sort of like what connections to pull, what to really look at versus like something that, you know, might not necessarily not be worth following, but would just take too many resources to keep up with?
One of the things that was helpful for us is that we were working with many historians and indigenous experts, and so it was a constant conversation showing what we had to them and being informed by a lot of their previous research. On the data side, it was there's no shortcut to that kind of stuff. It's just collecting everything as much as possible and constantly refining. I think one thing that's very helpful is having a clear end goal of what we wanted to show and then kind of kicking things out that were just distracting from that narrative. But happy to talk more about it. We have a methodology and user guide online, so we can talk more about that if you want.
Hi there. Bryn Nelson, a freelancer from Seattle. I don't know how many of you were freelance or were staff reporters, but one of the issues that I wanted to raise was that a lot of us want to do stories like this, but as freelancers, the indemnity clauses that we're signing are materially worse than they were a couple years ago. And we know that people are being attacked, both researchers and reporters, and sometimes challenged with lawsuits. So the question is, how, like, was that an issue at all for any of you? Or are there ways that we can help protect reporters from some of the blowback, including some of these legal threats?
I'm very recently a freelancer, so I unfortunately don't have a ton of insight into this. I don't know where he went, but I just to say that I empathize. I was on staff, I think, doing that work. This is why I believe in newsrooms having staff as opposed to freelance, especially for investigative reporting. It is a lot of risk to take on. I'm looking into this myself actively of like, how do I protect myself? I certainly take things like protection from like doxing and identity very seriously. There are services out there that aren't too expensive, like Delete Me, to like at least help with that. In terms of liability, that's like a whole other issue. I have not looked into the finances of like how much liability insurance there are insurances. How much that would cost on your own. I do think it's a problem.
Hi, Director of Investigations at Floodlight. Our stories, if we have freelancers write for us, they are covered underneath our indemnity clause. Basically, the concept is that if it's a story for us, our insurance protects us for the story. And when I was a freelancer for two years, I did not write big pieces for companies that would not cover me. So that was a choice I made. New York Magazine stood by me when I had a lawsuit threat. They were really good. Those are the kind of editors you want in your pocket. And those are questions you should ask as you're pitching, 100%. Places that won't do that, pitch them the easy stories that are not likely to get sued. But, you know, yeah, when you do these big pieces, you need a partner that's going all in with you and that's willing to take the hits because they will come.
Liza Gross, Inside Climate News. Quick question for Sharon. I wonder how EPA responded when you showed them the disparities in the numbers, and then I wonder, were they penalized for fabricating other than a change in the standard?
Yeah, I didn't even get to mention the craziest part of that story, which is that it's not just that a bunch of companies reduce their numbers without showing any evidence that they actually reduce their emissions. It was that in two cases, the companies admitted to me that someone at the EPA suggested they do so. I can't believe I left that out. Now everybody's gone from the room. But anyway, there were no penalties, but it was kind of, cited. I don't think that anyone was held to account for that. That was during the Trump administration that happened. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question.
I had a question for a few of you talked about, or some of your stories used emails from state lawmakers or between executives at like fossil fuel companies. And I noticed one of them had, it looked like there was a state lawmaker who was using maybe a Gmail account in an email. So I was just curious if you have tips about how did you get those emails? How do you go about those public records requests with legislators and executives?
Who wants to take that one?
Okay. So my particular blurb that I had was part of a document dump that we got anonymously. So that doesn't quite work in that situation because that's a dream scenario. But I have definitely, every state has different FOIA rules. So the federal government, you can't FOIA members of Congress, which is annoying, but you can FOIA emails of agency staff, which I did a lot when I used to work on the Hill. So I got a lot of great information, and you can just do any terms. Like, you could FOIA yourself, which some reporters actually did during the Trump administration, and there were some interesting stories there. But if, like, for example, there are bills being passed in your state and you're wondering what's behind them, like, how did this lawmaker get this idea? Who were they talking to in the lead up to writing this? How did they get this specific language? And your state allows you to FOIA, you know, Florida, for example, you can do this. So you can FOIA lawmakers' emails. So you should probably go back 6 months previous to when this bill came out and look at any sort of email to and from that specific member of Congress and his or state legislator and his staff, including the phrase solar panel or whatever the bill's number is or something very specific, and just dig. And some of the best stories you get are just reading some of those kind of, you know, dialogues between people as they're trying to figure this out. And so one of the workarounds that you can find, too, is that according to state law, it's supposed to include their personal email addresses, too. A lot of lawmakers try to skirt that by not writing those emails. But you can say any email owned by the lawmaker, both personal and public, and it's supposed to include that. Whether they'll give that to you is, you know, obviously a state-by-state, case-by-case basis, but that's one workaround.
This is a very quick thing, but before I was at The Guardian, years ago I was a local reporter in Baltimore, and one of the things that I did was just track really closely who quit city government and state government, especially people who were working on the issues that I was covering closely, because when people are angry and they quit in a huff, sometimes they're a lot more likely to tell you what to put in for your public information request than they would be otherwise. So talk to people who quit, I guess.
Did you want to wrap? Anything else?
Go birds!
Thank you all for your effort and attention and energy today. This was fantastic. With that, I believe we are off to the meet and greet. Thanks so much.